The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. With the primary election looming, it seemed like a good idea to host a discussion about the perpetual problem that haunts our fair city, an idea that author and consultant Brent Mandel had top of mind when he wrote his new book, Philadelphia Corrupt and Consenting, A City's Struggle Against an Epithet. Told through the stories of the corruption cases of John Dougherty and Bobby Heenan, Mandel's book illustrates the ways our inattention gives way to corrosive politicians and policies, the effects this blight has on Philadelphia, and how the collective action can lead to a better city for all. Brett Mandel served as director of Philadelphia's Financial and Policy Analysis Unit in the city's Comptroller's Office, and was a member of the Tax Reform Commission and an assistant policy director of the Philadelphia Independent Charter Commission. Mandel was also executive director of the National Education Technology Funding Corporation and executive director of the citizens organization Philadelphia Forward. Tonight, he'll be in conversation with Ernest Owens, editor-at-large of Philadelphia Magazine, host of the podcast Earnestly Speaking, and president of the Philadelphia Association of Black Journalists. Owens' book, The Case for Cancel Culture, was published in February and recently excerpted on the Rolling Stone website. Please welcome Brett Mandel and Ernest Owens.
Hello. Greetings. I'm not used to being on the moderating side of things, but I'm excited tonight to see you all here for a great conversation that we're going to be having here at the Free Library. I see a couple waves. Hi. So I guess I did get an introduction, but hi, I'm Ernest Owens. I'm the editor-at-large of Philadelphia Magazine, the president of the Philadelphia Association of Black Journalists, and I'm the author of this lovely book, The Case for Cancel Culture. And what a good surprise that talking about cancel culture and accountability, speaking truth to power, is something that I'm really big on. And the work that I do and the numerous stories that I'm writing on, I'm actually working on a really big story that might come out in the next couple of days that might shake the election. We'll see. But while doing all that work, I had the great joy and pleasure of being able to read a really great book and be a part of this experience with none other than Brett Mandel, who is somebody who has a storied history within the Philadelphia political scene. He, you know, ran for office previously and really did something that's very rare in the city, which is hold the the sheriff's office accountable, sued them after being wrongfully terminated, had a major six-figure settlement. Round of applause for that. It was $500,000 that was also broken off to him, the lawyer, and everyone else who was involved. Well, this is going to be fun tonight with taxpayers. And so, you know, he spoke truth to accountability, talked about it, was very public about it. And those are some of the things we have in common, next to being proud Penn alum. And it's our alumni weekend. So, you know, if you see people in the red and blue, say, hey. But really what was great about his book is that he doesn't talk a lot about that experience in his book, that you can Google or read down the road in some articles, but that what happened in that moment really was something that was bigger, that there has been, as you all know, and if you're reading the work that I do, a history of corruption in Philadelphia that's been going on forever. It's systemic, almost to be an epithet, as he says in his book, and it's something that has become second nature to the way that things operate. Like, you almost expect when people go into office that there's going to be dirty dealings. And we call it another term, Philly politics as usual. And so that is something that we know. And so before I begin talking and interviewing Brett, I wanted to read the review on the back of this book, which both of our books will be available on sale And we'll be signing them after this talk. And all sales and support will go to, from this book, Uncle Bobby's, which is a Black-owned bookstore. So please make sure you support local Black stores, Black-owned books, and everything else. But on the back of this lovely book that many of you I know, have, I see some people already have it, I have the first review at the top because I'm the most important reviewer on the top of the book. And well, you know, that's what he said. I didn't say that. So I'll read what my review was of the book. I really enjoyed it thoroughly. At a time when our city is at a political crossroads, Mandel's book arrives not a moment too soon. Philadelphia, Corrupt and Consenting, is the most riveting assessment in our city's infamous history of political corruption. Mandel leaves no stone unturned as he peels back the layers of how a local culture of complicity has led us to witnessing constant federal probes, indictments, and convictions. This is a must-read for any concerned citizen, regardless of political affiliation. And that was from me. That was my review. Thank you.
Good job.
Thank you. It got enough to be on the back of the book. So there's two great books here. So I read the book, and it really struck out to me. I'm also cited in the book. He uses his bibliography very well and cites many articles that I've written about political corruption over the years. But really what stood out to me the most about the book is that it's very frank. It's very unapologetic. It's somebody who's walked the walk, talked the talk, experienced these things up front, and was so gracious enough to share those experiences about various moments in council and city council and all these different things. And so it was really important for me to say that at a time like this, right before our Tuesday election, think about that. That right before our Tuesday election, this is a book about corruption. You should read the history. Some of these characters, because they are characters, are still influencing Philly politics as we know it today. They're making endorsements. The history of what they've done in their offices are creating systemic issues in current offices that are being up. There are several contested races. There are several people running for office. But the book really gives you a background history of some of the things that we were promised 4 years ago that didn't change these 4 years later. It's a lot to think about. And this book is a real great testament to civic responsibility and education. So it's an important book. I think many people will continue to read it long after this election. I know I will.
I hope so.
And I think a lot of people will be reading this. These are complimentary texts. These are companion reads. You should read about Philadelphia corruption, and then you should read about cancel culture and how to cancel the corruption. So these are dual reads. So you have to figure out how you want to do it, but you should get the deluxe. We don't have a group set bundle package, but we guarantee that both of these great books are great to read because you could read first about what's going on with corruption, and you're going to be pissed off about it. What do I do about it? You can read this. They go together. You can't read this without knowing this because you might say, canceling, is anything worth canceling? I hate cancel culture. And then you're like, well, actually, there's a lot of things you should cancel, and it's in this book. So they go together. Don't you think?
I think so.
Thank you. So before we begin, we're going to I want to ask him some questions, and then I will open it up to you all, you great people. Who will probably have some wonderful questions. So I guess the first start of this is, for starters, how do you feel? It's a lot going on. Your name has been in articles again because someone at your office you left many years, just a couple years ago, they're now running for re-election. That's the sheriff's office. So how do you feel right now in the midst of everything that's going on in the world?
Before I tell you how I feel, yeah. Let me thank the Free Library for hosting this. This is a very meaningful place for me. With this book, it's also been a place where I have seen a number of terrific author talks, so it's fun to be up here instead of being in the audience waiting for someone like Buzz Aldrin or Jimmy Carter to sign my book. I'm certainly not in that stratosphere. But a lot of the research that I did for the book happened here in this building, including reading some of the books that you're not allowed to take out of the library from the rare books. The hero of one of the chapters in history, the policy entrepreneur who helped with the city-county consolidation of 1854, wrote a book about it and what it took to do that. And I got a chance to read that upstairs in the government documents area. And what was moving about it was the book was signed by Eli Kirk Price, the hero of the 1854 consolidation. Wow. And you know, here I am holding his book signed in his hand right in this building. So how do I feel? I feel, one, real nervous about the Sixers tonight. I'm very excited that my son is in the audience and he's going to give me an update on the scores, so I'll tell you how we're doing.
He'll just be like doing a thumbs up.
Exactly.
Thumbs down
we'll,
the
so we'll get a running tally on that. But the Sixers are going to win tonight. I'm fine about that.
Okay.
I'm nervous about the election because I'm not sure that the election is going to mean anything. And what I mean by that is someone's going to win the mayor's election with 20 low percent of the vote and then claim some mandate that, obviously the people wanted me. I don't know, 70% of the people didn't want you.
Right.
So I'm nervous about how anybody who wins this election is going to govern. And I'm very frustrated because the point about the book that is important is not that Philadelphia is corrupt. That's well documented. The point is that we are consenting, that we allow this to happen through our inaction. And
so this is the difference between Chicago.
Perhaps, yes. In other cities, as I talk about in the book, there have been reactions to corruption. Somebody has done something. There have been movements to try to do something about it. We've talked about a lot in this election. We've talked about the Sixers arena. We've talked about safe injection sites. We've talked about crime, of course, and education and whose PACs are doing what. The one thing we haven't talked about at all in this election is corruption and who has done anything about it. And none of the candidates have distinguished themselves, mayor, council, certainly in the row offices or whatever, to say, you know what, we need to do something about that. And that's, of course, frustrating. So I would not be shocked if 20 years from now, when my son is writing a book about Philadelphia corruption, he doesn't say, you know what, not much changed.
Interesting. You know, it is has been a lot of candidates. But when you look at the candidates, I mean, all of them, even the progressive ones, are somewhat connected to that. You know, they are supported by people who are now behind bars.
This is a clubby town.
This is
a small town. When my son and I were walking over here, we live in Center City. We passed by Ed Bacon's old house where Kevin Bacon lived. And right. I talk about how the Hollywood game of 7 or 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon.
Yes.
We are all 1 degree from everybody corrupt in this city.
That's right.
The worst corruptors are connected to the most righteous reformers by 1 degree of separation. And every single person running for this office or running for office in town, and me and you, knows somebody who has either been down with the corruption, participated in the corruption, or looked the other way on the corruption.
I mean, yeah, one moment you can, you know, be at the Union League, and in the next moment you can have Bernie Sanders and AOC.
That's
you know,
right.
At your rally.
One of the interesting things, alluding to Helen Gim having AOC and Bernie Sanders, my former college professor, coming to Philadelphia.
Right.
They split on one policy initiative. Bernie Sanders, if you might remember, in 2016 during the election, was against the soda tax,
That
as a regressive move that would hurt the poor. Of course, Helen Gim and Philadelphia progressives liked the idea of the soda tax to fund pre-K and to fund the rebuild program. But what we find out in the trial of union leader John Dougherty and councilperson Bobby Heenan is that the soda tax had nothing to do with public policy, had nothing to do with funding worthy programs or stopping people from drinking sugary drinks. It was a way for John Dougherty to strike back at the Teamsters Union that he thought wronged him and the electricians in a ad for against the Jim Kenney election.
And when asked about this, Gim said, innocence of proven guilty in regards to Bobby Heenan.
But that's the striking thing in the book, is that what drives public policy in Philadelphia is not what's good for the folks. It's not what would make Philadelphia a preferred place to live, to work, to visit. What drives Philadelphia policy is corruption.
Right.
Private interests,
yes.
Putting private interests before public good.
Right. And so what's interesting, a lot of people don't know this, and I found this out in Marina book, is that Brett wrote this book before his own endeavors with the sheriff's office, which I was surprised because I thought that after something as magnificent or as big as that, that would inspire you to write the book, right? I mean, I had some moments in my life with council culture that inspired me to write the book, which we talk about and all that. But in this situation, it was opposite. It was almost like you was predetermining your own experience. So before you even had a personal direct encounter with corruption yourself, you was already writing a book about it.
Yeah. despite every reason to not, I still believe in Philadelphia. And I still think Philadelphia can be, should be, a place where people want to be. But you and I both know that Philadelphia is not the place where we want it to be. It is not as safe a city as it should be. It's not as clean a city as it should be. It's not a city of opportunity for too many people. And there's a lot of reasons for this, but underlying most of the reasons is because too many of our leaders, too many public officials, are putting private gain before the public good, are abusing their public authority to advance private interests, and are perverting the work of public systems that should work for us in a way that they work for the connected. And so something has to change for this to get better. And I have, over the course of my career, to the extent that you would call it a career, have been inside of government. I've been outside of government trying to push for improvements. I've run for political office. I've supported candidates trying to get to the bottom of this. And it was the frustration of all that, that after John Doherty was indicted and it was clear that this was going to be a big deal, that I said, you know what? I might not be a good politician, but I'm not a bad writer. And I've written a few books about baseball and about Philadelphia, so I thought, what if I tried to lay it out there as clear as I can what corruption is? Because I think people are not so sure that they understand what corruption is. People think corruption is like me coming to your office with a bundle of cash and making, you know, an offer you can't refuse, or you shaking me down as I'm trying to open up some restaurant or something.
Or you're wrangling a bunch of black elected officials to endorse a black candidate last minute.
Yeah, something like that. But it's the endless series of ways in which the city is working for the connected few and not for the folks. And if I could lay this out, if I could write this as clearly as possible, if I can go through the history of why this is different in Philadelphia, why Philadelphia corruption has evolved the way it did, what's the cost of corruption, how corruption in Philadelphia compares to other places, maybe someone will pick this book up and say, you know what, I'm going to do something about it. And where, you know, Brett Mandel was not a good politician, maybe somebody out there is a good politician who's going to say, you know what, we're going to make some change. And in the middle of all this, the sheriff did call and say, Brett, I'm trying to reform this office. Will you come and help me reform the office? And I said, yeah, I'll give that a shot. And
so this was happening while you were writing the book?
It happened while I was...
So you thought you was going to the office to change?
I thought I was going into the office for change, and turned out I had a brief stay.
5 weeks.
5 weeks.
That's epic.
It was a good 5 weeks.
You could even stay for the whole, you know, what they call a probationary period.
That's true.
You'd even make it through a probationary period, you know, like 90 days. They were like...
I invested in the city's pension fund from my previous service in government.
Okay.
So I padded my pension by 5 weeks. I will get an extra couple of nickels when I retire because of those 5 weeks.
And she's still in office.
She's still in office, and unfortunately, I'm going to tell you, she's going to win re-election because most folks in Philadelphia won, aren't focused on her race, and two, are supporting her for re-election.
You don't think anything's going to change?
I don't think so.
The party's endorsed her.
The party endorsed her. A number of good progressive candidates have endorsed her.
Mm-hmm.
Sheriff Rochelle Bilal.
She's the current
sheriff. For those of you who don't know, and perhaps... I was hired to work in the office of the sheriff of Philadelphia. The sheriff's office is a notorious den of political iniquity that has been a terrible place for years and years and years in terms of money being stolen from the people, public money being diverted to private interests. And I was hired as the CFO of the sheriff's office. And the week that I got there and said, hey, you know, I think it's illegal to spend money in this way. We shouldn't do it. I was relieved of my responsibilities and ultimately walked out of the sheriff's office under armed guard.
And he sued.
And won.
And won.
Or
$500,000 settlement.
At least won a settlement. So someone called me and said, Brett, I heard you settled your case and you won. So actually, I shouldn't say you won. You tied. And I said, ain't no tie. I didn't give the sheriff any money.
McQueen, yes. And this is all taxpayers' dollars, by the way. Had people did the right thing, my taxpayers' dollars, your taxpayers' dollars would have been used. It could have been used to better things, you know, in the community, right? So I mean, we didn't even have to have a soda tax. We would have just been able to pay for schools and parks and recs with that money. So in your book, one thing that stood out to me, and I want to note it, is that every chapter you have what I call throwing shade, but you pretty much start off every chapter, and I'm going to read one of them. Most of them, you have a quote, and it's an interesting quote that kind of stirs the pattern. So, chapter one
an
is called...
An
appetizer.
A mousse bouche.
So, I'll give you a couple examples, because I actually do find this fascinating. So, on chapter one, and I'm going to go to chapter 29 next, he said, the chapter's called One of Us, Corruption Defined. The quote that starts it off is, I'm not making rookie mistakes. That was by Johnny Doc. So then we move to page 29, and he goes, quote, if these investigations were simply about me, I'd retire today and save our union any additional headaches, but they're not. That quote is by Johnny Doc. So he starts off with all these different quotes for some people who've experienced some level of corruption. What drove you to start the chapters off with those particular openings up, those warm-ups and those quotes? It's interesting how they kind of tell a story. They start off, I feel like there's a theme there. I could be wrong. But it starts off kind of like a, not so bad. And then it builds and it builds and it builds to the end. So very suspenseful. It should be like a miniseries.
I think each quotation that starts each chapter is a bit of a slap in the face.
Right.
Because frankly, taken out of context, you read these lines and you think, who the heck is saying this? Or who has the gall to say that? Or who would admit this, either in public or in private, saying what they do? My personal favorite, if you allow me, is the chapter that begins... this is by the council president.
Darrell Clark.
He's quoted this. The quotation is about the parking authority. And at one point, there was a move to call on the controller to audit the parking authority by some members in council. And it became a central point of the trial of Bobby Heenan that he was perhaps being bribed by the head of the parking authority who bought his mistress windows or installed windows in his mistress' house in exchange, perhaps, for Heenan's help killing the move to audit the parking authority. And Darrell Clark at one point is picked up on a surveillance conversation wiretap talking about the parking authorities. And he basically says, you know, we know that what they're doing is bad. He says, but there are guys. We look the other way. And that's the story of Philadelphia corruption is it's not so much that the bad guys are doing bad things. There are bad guys doing bad things all over the place. It's the consenting. It's that we who know the bad guys are doing bad things don't stand up and say, no, that's bad. You can't do that. We need to do something different.
Right. So a question I had that really stood out to me, just reading this book, and you talk a little bit about it, and I don't want to give it away, but what do you think, like, on a basic surface level of why you think it is easy for people in Philadelphia to be corrupted? So, you know, fun fact or interesting fact, I was born in Chicago, but I grew up in Houston, Texas most of my life. I've lived in Philadelphia for 13 years. I came here through the University of Pennsylvania, met my husband at Penn, stayed, live here, love it, all that good stuff. What is interesting is I was a communications fellow at City Council. My husband is a communications director for a very ethical city councilwoman in City Council. And what I've tried to figure out throughout all of this is what makes Philadelphia politics unique. And, you know, I live in Houston where we've already had an elected LGBTQ mayor, Anise Parker. We've had plenty of black mayors. We've had lots of diverse city council members. And we've had Republicans and Democrats that are able to come to the table and find some level of common ground, you know? But I think my observation about Philly, and I have to say this about the elected system, is that we have a lot of dumb people that win for dumb reasons. I have no interest in running for office. I'm 31 years old, and my mind's not going to change on that. But it's just ridiculous who runs and who gets elected and why they get elected. Yeah. And I think it almost sets up the problem from the jump. You see it in the campaigns. You see it in the way that people prop them. You see it in the way that people endorse people. They don't endorse them because of the fact they're like, oh, they're smart, they're this, we did questionnaires. It's someone who's really powerful, makes a phone call. You know, in our circles, in my circles, we call it a get down or lay down conversation. And it's literal. They'll say, listen, this is what we're doing. If you don't do it, you know, you're in trouble. So people are really forced into making these decisions. And a lot of times when you see candidates that you admire, that you say, this is a good person, why are they endorsing this person? a lot of times that is driven by these connected relationships. Philly is a very small town. People always say it's a big city masquerading as a, it's a small town masquerading as a big city is what people will say. And that shapes the way that people in Philadelphia operates because everyone went to school with somebody. They know someone from yonder 20 years ago. And when I interview a lot of these politicians, I've done these big stories, I'll ask them like, you know, so why do you support this person? Oh, well, you know, their father and I grew up together and their father and I was a great man. Like, their father, and their father is probably dead, but they made this deaf promise that they were going to keep them and take care of them. And then they kind of pass on the baton. And so it's never really about anything of actual material substance. It's really something that's sentimental. It's really something that is very personal. But they're doing it with positions that are having decision-making power that impact all of our lives. Yeah. And so when I think about why poverty continues, why we haven't seen an advancement in technology and new opportunities in jobs, we don't see a lot of ethical, civic development when we continue to see certain people get contracts that we're like, how do they get contracts? And we see offices continue to get a slap on the wrist. We see the abuse of identity politics being used as a way to justify the mediocrity of elected officials. It's because of those relationships and how small this city is and how the fact that I think 75% of people in Philadelphia live here, stay here, born here, probably die here. And because of those interpersonal relationships, it takes a lot.
So that's essentially chapter three of my book.
Yes. Like,
why Philadelphia? And yes, you know, Philadelphians live in Philadelphia, and Philadelphians stay in Philadelphia, and Philadelphians know each other for generations. And the lack of new blood is striking in Philadelphia, unlike other cities that have a lot more blood, more new blood. We are all connected to each other. It's a city of row homes. We are all close to each other. We are all one of us. Philadelphia, unlike other cities, did not have two-party systems where there's competition in government. We were a one-party town for Republicans for a long, long time, 70-some years, and now have been a one-party town for Democrats for 70-some years. Other cities would have a robust political competition. One of the things that's interesting when you talk about some of the things, the dealings, who gets a contract, who gets this, a lot of what is corrupt is not necessarily illegal. It is not illegal to give someone a campaign contribution. It's not illegal to give someone who gave a campaign contribution a no-bid contract, as long as it meets the campaign finance rules. But if you put the quid a little bit too close to the pro quo, it's illegal. Regardless of whether it's illegal, it's corrupt if only people that give you money are getting contracts.
So, like, for example, Kenyatta Johnson and his wife, what they did wasn't technically criminal, but
it may have been. A jury acquitted.
I want to be specific. I'm just saying, like, the difference oftentimes is a conflation here, that what is criminal is automatically unethical, and what is things that are unethical are not necessarily criminal, and people sometimes don't understand that just because you can do it don't mean you should do it.
Right.
And just because you can do it and the law says it's permissible doesn't mean it's still not wrong.
So in my book, I define corruption.
Right.
And I define corruption as putting private gain before public good, abusing public authority to advance private interests, and then perverting the government
systems.
Oh, my
gosh, so everyone's corrupt in city council for the most part.
Well, you know what? There are a lot of things that are happening as a matter of course that you would look at and say, well, wait a second, that's not the way it should work. And it's in Philadelphia, when you say that's just typical Philadelphia politics, there are folks in Philadelphia who, if you say to them, well, or if they said to you something like, well, of course my campaign contributors are going to get contracts. Why would I give the contracts to somebody who didn't contribute to the campaign? Or of course, if you donate to my campaign, I'm going to favor you when I'm offering contracts.
Well, if somebody buys a $100,000 table, or no, I'm sorry, a $100,000 ticket to go to Steak 48...
which has lousy steaks.
Yeah. Not even a Uniontown. I mean, $100,000 to go see Jeff Brown when you can see him for free at Fresh Grocer or ShopRite. But you can spend $100,000
to
be there and get a ticket.
The thought exercise that I ask people who say things like, well, that's just typical. That's just normal.
$100,000 to go to a Steak 48 dinner is typical?
If your house were on fire and you called 911 And 911 responded, 911, what's your emergency? And you said, my house is on fire. And 911 said, well, let me figure out how to prioritize this. Did you contribute to the mayor? Or did you contribute to your council person? And if the answer is, well, we're going to dole out government services like this if you're a contributor, or like this if you're not, you would say that that's horrible. But when politicians will say, well, of course, if you give me money, of course, if you're part of my political family, I'm going to favor you.
So you're saying Jeffrey Yass is ahead of me in the line?
Jeffrey Yass probably would be ahead of you in the line. Damn. He would be ahead of me, too.
I try. It's true. I mean, this can be considered legal.
No question.
People in city council can get multiple jobs. They can do speaking engagements. They can do other things. They can be on boards. Boards can pay them. And sometimes, if you're Johnny Dock, you can just buy a city council seat.
So in the book, it talks a lot about the trial of Bobby Heenan, councilperson Bobby Heenan, who was, while he was a councilperson, also under the employ of Local 98 and John Dougherty. Kind of quiet. It wasn't published until, this became public, and then there's nothing illegal about it. Council people in Philadelphia, it's legal to have an outside job. But, of course, when council members are advocating for a raise, they always say, this job is 24/7. I'm always on the clock.
What's funny is that compared to other cities, and this is something that my husband and I talk about all the time, is that other cities, city councils don't have this full-time job thing. It's like it's like student council in high school. You know, it's an extracurricular activity. You show up, you do a couple of meetings, and you get back to work. If you live in Yaden or Lower Merion, I have friends who live in the outer suburbs. They have county commissioners. These people, they show up, they have meetings, but it's not a salary that pays them like it could be a full-time job. But it's one of the many things they do. And the funny thing is they're not as corrupt. Now, Yaden, there are some things in Yaden. But it's not as intense as what we see in Philly. And so part of that is maybe the fact that we are a city that manufactures career politicians. We are the, listen, I've lived in some other cities. This is career politicians. Like, when I grew up, when you thought being a politician, you thought U.S. senator, congressperson, president. You didn't think city council. You didn't think, I mean, growing up, you just didn't think, no one was like, I want to be a city council member. You knew mayor was a big deal, but you never thought of these other jobs. But in Philadelphia, a district council person is like the mini mayor. You know, they run that area. They have power of like councilmatic prerogative. They have access to zoning. They have these decisions. I mean, look at this conversation we're having right now about the 76ers arena, which, disclaimer, to be clear, full transparency, supporting the 76ers winning the series does not mean supporting the 76ers arena.
Ooh.
Just to be clear, because I support one thing and I don't support the other thing. I think you can guess which one it is. Go Sixers tonight.
Sixers down early, though.
Oh. So these are the things, though. Like, we have these conversations, and in your book, you talk about all of these moments where there could have been a judgment change. So I look at, like, a Greek tragedy. And if you know the arc of a Greek tragedy, there's always that point of no return. I forget what we called it in school, but there's always, my favorite part of a Greek tragedy is, like, that point of no return where you could either go this way or go that way. And then the person goes the other way, and their destiny is sealed. I mean, that's how my teacher taught it. She's like, this is the part where everything changes. This is the part where they could have done the other thing. So the Little Mermaid's coming out again. And remember how she's deciding in that part of the story whether she wants to give her voice to Ursula to see what you're not. And the plot can go. She could say no, Ursula, and she can go back to, being obscure. Or she could take a risk and meet the man of her dreams and live her best life. She chooses to go the other direction. And Ursula takes the voice and go, And I feel like in city council, it's that moment, right? That moment where, well, whatever. You can have a moment where you shake a hand and there's that person that says, look, make this decision, shake this hand. And then everything changes. You know, that decision to get that endorsement from someone suspicious, that decision to take that weird policy stance, that decision to one moment get an endorsement at the Working Families Party, but then somehow find yourself in Ewing the same night. It's that moment where you had a choice to choose your decision and you go a different direction.
And that's the consenting, right?
Right.
That's the idea that you can make a decision and say, well, if I make this compromise, I'll gain this amount of power, this amount of authority, and I'll be able to use it for good. and then you compromise a little bit here, and then you turn your head there, and then you look the other way here, and then you say, you know what, I wasn't able to do very much good.
So it's like the Robin Hood effect. Maybe. All of them think they're Robin Hood. Yeah. Every you agree? Yes? No? Not all of them, but some of them have the Robin Hood perspective. They say, look, this is how you have to do it in Philly politics. There's no way you can avoid the dirtiness of it all. You got to make certain deals. But at the end of the day, I'm doing it not for me, but for you. And so they do some of these weird odd job deals because they think it's going to support the greater good.
And perhaps if the streets were paved with gold and were clean and we didn't have the crime and we didn't have the underperforming schools and we didn't have everything about Philadelphia that we look at and say, my God, if only this weren't this way, this would be the most wonderful city in the world. Then maybe you could say, hey, you know what? It's corrupt, but it's wonderful. And, you know, we're willing to let the politicians have what they want because the city is terrific. But it's not. And that's the corrupt and consenting title is based on 1904 muckraker Lincoln Steffens, who referred to Philadelphia as corrupt and contented. He was talking about the shame of all the cities and the corruption that hurt all the cities, but he singled out Philadelphia for particular damnation because it wasn't just that we were corrupt, it was we didn't care about it. We were contented that we were corrupt. Well, there's not so much to be contented about in Philadelphia. That's the thing that was always damning. The fact that we consent, the fact that so many politicians who would say to us, I care, that I'm going to make a difference, I'm going to make change, then get into office and allow this to happen.
Yeah.
That's what defines Philadelphia corruption.
Absolutely. And I have one last question before I open up to the audience. But I, you know, where I live in West Philly is the 190th district. I think it then relocates to the 10th and it's been redistricting. But I lived in the 190th. And so in my tenure, we have Vanessa Laurie Brown, who then eventually, you know, corrupt, she gets convicted. Then after her, we have Movita Johnson-Harrell, she gets convicted. And now we have Amon Brown, who's running for mayor. So we have a lot of things going on in West Philadelphia, bless his heart. But we have these things, and it's interesting, because in my, you talk about the consenting. One year when Vanessa was running, she was under investigation. I think she was indicted at that point, and she still won.
And she's not alone. It's people are run for office under indictment in Philadelphia seemingly all the time.
So there's a lot of people that supported her that necessarily weren't corrupt themselves, but they were complicit in that. And I think in my book I talk about that as well, this idea that the worst people in this situation aren't the elected officials. It's the people. It's the people that have accepted this as the norm, have created excuses about it, have come to terms with it, and don't want to say anything. And so my last question to you, from me, before we answer, open up to the audience, is, you know, what is something that everyday people can do in their lives to not become so consenting?
Yeah. The cover of the book, if you've seen it, is a picture of City Hall reflected in a rainy day, you know, on the street. And I liked the picture because what I talk about the corruption in Philadelphia is a mirror. What we get in City Hall is a mirror of what we put out there. Philadelphians want to get a hookup. Philadelphians want to be able to park in some place close to the ballpark, sneak down to the good seats, even though you bought a seat way up in the 700 level. That's very, very Philadelphian. And who's going to judge anybody else who would do that? Now, this is the town of Joey Coyle, you know, low-level drug addict who stumbles upon a bag of Federal Reserve money and gets acquitted by a jury of his peers who says, you know, who among us wouldn't have taken that money and done something with it.
Damn.
What can we do? We can demand that people say something. We can say something ourselves. We can ask our politicians, will you do something about this? Will you stop doing this? Again, to start or to turn back to where we started a little bit, this mayoral election, nobody has asked the candidates, will you demand something different? Will you change something in the rules, in the laws? Will you appoint different officials? Will you take an honor code pledge?
To be fair, people do ask those questions. They just don't answer them. If you go to, I mean, I'm a journalist, so the one thing I would add before I get to the other idea is that you see at the candidate forums that they ask the question of who will, you know, do away with certain elected officials. they'll say, oh, I can't answer that question. That's not right. A question I can answer right now. That's a mayoral decision that the mayor will decide. And it's like, well, let's audition for mayor now, right? Shall we? You know? And you know, one person, Alan Dom, said he would abolish the sheriff's office.
Yeah.
He's the only person. Who would think he'd be the radical saying he's going to abolish the sheriff's
office? That's right.
Alan Dom, abolitionist. So,
I'm just saying,
like, who would have thought he would be the one to do it? You know, meanwhile, the other progressive candidate, the socialist, I'm joking, you know, would say something along the lines of like, oh, I can't answer that question. That's no right. Clear-cut position. But Dom is like, no, it's corrupt. He
That's
said
right.
it's corrupt.
That's
and he
right.
said he would abolish it.
He was right.
So you have, and he also, there's other people that said that they would call for the police commission to step down. There are people that do it. But, you know, the other thing is that people are scared of politicians.
Yeah. The book concludes with recommendations for change.
Yes,
and,
yes, it does.
And there are definitely recommendations. There are things that we can do to disconnect the world of getting elected and raising the resources to get elected from the governing of the city. And there are things that we can do to unbalance the fraud triangle that encourages some people to do the wrong thing. But ultimately, the biggest thing that we have to do is we have to change. We have to expect better of our leaders. We have to demand better from our leaders. We have to hold them accountable. We have to stop saying, well, you know, Ernest is good, but this is over here, but the good outweighs the bad.
Right.
No, we have to say the bad,
but
we
that's
can't
true
take
for me,
the
though.
Bad.
No, but you're right, though. And I think one of the things that also is there is the power of free speech. You could also go to journalists, too. You can talk to people like me, and I'll carry it out.
I think ultimately when I was in the sheriff's office and I came across the stuff that I came across, mm-hmm. and I said, okay, this is the stuff that you've been writing about for the past 5 years.
Right.
And John Dougherty, his house was raided in 2016. I started writing the book like that fall,
mm-hmm.
and then the indictment took forever to come, and then the trial took forever to come. So the book was a long time sort of in the writing and halfway finished. When I went to the sheriff's office, all the things that I had written about had already been memorialized to pages. And so when I had the chance to say, all right, Brett, you know, what are you going to do in this situation? I had to say something. And, of course, people didn't take that so well.
No, but the journalists did.
Yeah, the journalists were happy.
The press did. I think people read it. And it's also the thing, too, is about just simply that there's various ways to do it. There's whistleblower types of ways. There's talking to the press. It's, you know, just using your own platforms to speak about this. You'd be surprised that so many of them, their egos and vanity get hit when you see people publicly call them out. You'd be surprised. Like, if you actually add an elected official's account or say something on social media, that stings them more than private conversations or closed meetings. The public outrage and disgust, if it magnifies, it can change something. You know, there's one candidate that recently, in 24 hours, changed their whole position about something because of just how people in publicly on social media change. You know, I think, for example, Erin Sansomore, she, you know, said in a forum that she supported stop and frisk, constitutional stop and frisk. Let me clarify. Constitutional stop and frisk, whatever that means. It's oxymoronic. It's like saying constitutional groping. You're like, oh, is there a constitutional way to grope someone? Anyway, but in this situation, people reacted, voters reacted, people were not happy about it. And within 24 hours, she completely publicly held herself accountable. She said she, you know, that, you know, that she made a mistake and she acknowledged she was wrong. She talked about how she would, you know, that looking into that policy, it's not a just policy and it's not something that she stands for. And in her administration, if she's elected, she would not support it. I hadn't seen an elected official do something like that a candidate running for office do that so fast within a 24, you know, hour cycle. But the power of it was that there was no articles in the press. So it wasn't like there was, like, bad actual press, but it was just a public outrage of people going on social media and speaking about it. And so in real time, we're seeing some level of people using their platforms in a way to challenge people and speak truth to power, not necessarily canceling them, but going to that route when it's necessary. So we're going to open the floor up to questions. But before I do that, round of applause for Brett and his incredible book.
Sixers are still down.
They're still down. All right, so we'll take some questions from the audience. Please raise your hand.
I have two related questions.
Okay.
You mentioned Jeffrey Yass, who is a billionaire and probably the richest person in Pennsylvania.
He is.
But and he lives in Haverford. So why is he meddling in the election? He's, you know, funding campaign ads against certain candidates. And then the second part is, isn't this conversation incomplete without addressing suburbs that don't care about the city or are Republican leaning, and the rest of the state, which is, you know, more like Pennsylvania, and very hostile? And that's partly why this will always be a Democratic city, because of that force, major force.
Thanks. So with regard to the second part of the question about our place in the Commonwealth, number one, Pennsylvania has not distinguished itself well in the anti-corruption world either. Pennsylvania is a place where lots and lots of public officials have gone to jail, have gone to prison, have been involved in corruption. So Philadelphia is a part of that. One of the things that is interesting in Philadelphia history in terms of, like, maybe fighting corruption. Classically, in any situation, we have a choice of exiting, we have a choice of being loyal, or we have a choice of speaking out. And in Philadelphia, a lot of people have voted with their feet and said, you know what, I like the hot, humid summers of the area, I like the underperforming sports teams that drive us nuts, but I just want to be living outside the city of Philadelphia. But I still want to participate in the government of Philadelphia, maybe give some money, maybe support some causes. Except if you're a candidate in Philadelphia who may want some change, and you're supported by people in the suburbs who may want some change, you are damned for having outsider support. So that doesn't help us. And trying to build bridges to the suburbs to maybe help with funding for the schools or something else will damn you as a politician, because, well, you're a traitor to the Philadelphians, even though maybe you're trying to get something done. That's a frustration. For the first question about Jeff Yaz, who is a ridiculously wealthy guy, and instead of, you know, buying the Sixers and making them great, he's decided to try to change elections and move folks towards his point of view, or at least elect people who share his point of view. The interesting thing about that, though, is, to me, there are true believers in politics, and then there are investors in politics. Mm. And there are people who invest in politics so that they can own politicians or rent politicians and then maybe win back some private benefit, whether it's a contract or something that benefits them.
He reminds me of that guy in House of Cards, that really rich guy in House of Cards, remember what I'm talking about? That's the guy. That's him. If you know what I'm talking about, that's him.
But Yaz, for good or for bad, seems to want what he wants, like school choice and different things that may or may not be good. I don't get the sense that what he's looking for is a contract for himself. He seems like he could buy anything he wants. and in some ways, that's not damaging to the system, where the buying somebody for private good is damaging, and yet Yaz is damned because he represents a particular politics, and so folks would rather oppose somebody who wants conservative policies in favor of somebody who's stealing from the public.
It's like the Koch brothers all over again. Yeah.
Gentlemen, was there ever a time, you're relating this to history, was there ever a time when there was less corruption because there was a two-party system versus the one dominant one-party system now, Brett? And my second question is going to be based on that answer.
Yes. So, of course, in the book, as I talk about in the book, the history of Philadelphia is a lot of waxing and waning of corruption. The corruption waxes and then sometimes wanes when a reform effort will be put forward. So there are some times in the early 1900s, the gas wars were a particular ripe time for reform, and Philadelphia elected Rudolf Blankenship, who was a reform mayor, and for a moment there was some competition intra-Republican politics in the Republican Party. In the 1950s, obviously, when the Democrats took hold, there was a moment there where there was some level of competitiveness and some level of spirit of reform. But really, the history of Philadelphia is, for every reform movement that makes an advance, then there is a relapse. Plunkett of Tammany Hall, the one who's famous for saying, "I seized my opportunities and I took them," the New York politician, also referred to reformers as morning glories. You know, they thrive in the morning but then shrivel up by the afternoon. The advice for any reformer is, you better bring lunch, because the people who are looking to profit from the system, they're lifers. They're in it for a career, And so the reform movement takes hold, maybe takes some shape, but then will fall back. And so despite a couple of places in the history of the city where, you know what, for a shining moment there, there's something good happening, we always seem to retreat back to the clubby, well, you know, it's better to know a judge than it is to know the law.
I got it. So not to pick on Rebecca Reinhart, as much as I admire her and see that, believe that she's eminently qualified because she's got the background, she knows where the bodies are buried, so to speak, it just seems from your description that because she wouldn't want to embarrass the party, because she has aspirations to do other things, that she really couldn't take the steps and point out the embarrassing things that would require a real change. So then the answer is, we really need a second party. I mean, that's...
I don't think political competition would be bad, whether it's from another party or whether we change the way we vote to have ranked choice voting or to have one of those primaries where the top two get to run off against each other no matter what party they are. Definitely competition helps. And my comment about Rebecca Reinhart would just be, she's certainly not alone. She's not the only one who has looked the other way on everything. She probably has looked the other way less than some. But nobody in this race has distinguished themselves as an anti-corruption crusader.
Or you can just read the audits and then act accordingly. I would like to hear from a woman.
So I wanted to get your thoughts on this idea of, you spoke to the fear of politicians, and given your experience about retaliation, I have a colleague who did speak out about a council person's, you know, dirty dealings, ended up having all the grants, city grants, pulled from their nonprofit, had to step down from their position in order for the nonprofit to recover. So what's your advice for everyday people who might have a real fear of these politicians and what might happen if they do speak out?
That's a good question.
I think that's a reality, unfortunately. And in a city where we are all so tightly connected to everybody, this person might be on my board, I might be friends with so-and-so, so-and-so is married to such-and-such, that's what makes it hard. And I think if we all agreed to not play the game, and if we all stood up and said, wait, we're going to stand up to this system of bullies, we could make change. One of us doing it doesn't really help so much. And I can tell you from my personal experience, when I said what I said, it wasn't like the world made a parade to my house to carry me down the street and throw a parade to me. For me, there were plenty of friends that I had in the city and in the city law department, in the city administration, who would stop returning my calls, who would stop hanging out and being social. It's not pleasant and it's not good. But the only way to defeat a bully is to all stand together. That's what we have to do ultimately.
Thank you. I just wanted to kind of piggyback off of what you just said. I think my concern is originally from the suburbs, but lifelong Philadelphian, is that that puts so much pressure on us as individuals, whereas the government is truly a system. And I think many of us, especially people in this room tonight, might wish for a more realistic solution than all of us as a city of 2 million, I think, maybe if I Googled it, standing up arm in arm. The only individual I can imagine doing that is like maybe Jason Kelsey or something, but is there anything else? Like, is there any systemic recommendations that you could add to that?
There are definitely recommendations of rules and laws and procedures that we can change that are helpful, but the optimistic side that I would say is this. Philadelphia likes to say this is a tough town. Philadelphia is not a tough town. Philadelphia is a gang tough town. And the people in Philadelphia who are tough are gang tough. They're tough when people are standing behind them. Nobody likes to be called out. As Ernest mentioned, one person standing up in a meeting and saying, what you're talking about is wrong, what you're doing is wrong, and they're petrified. And they look around, who's going to fight for me? Who's going to be with me? When we look at what has happened since the John Dougherty trial and since the Bobby Heenan trial, shamefully, politicians in Philadelphia did not stand up and condemn this and did not stand up and say, we're going to make change. On the other hand, nobody fought for them. Nobody ransacked the federal building and said, how dare you convict these people of these offenses. If a few of us stand up, and I see a few faces in the audience who are doing things and running for office, and God bless them for doing this, it only takes a few. And beating a bully doesn't mean I have to stand alone and beat the bully. But if there's two or three of us who stand together, and three or four of us who stand together, we can flip this.
And I also just add, like, in my book, I kind of talk about that. In the sense
you wrote a book?
I did. I did. That's why you're here. I'm joking. So what I'll say is that with this book, I do talk a little bit, piggybacking off of that, and saying that, to your point, there's other ways that we can do it and different ways that we can consent. It's reviews, right? If it's elected officials, voting those people out, talking to the press, I mean, God, give us the receipts. We'll put the pieces together and amplify it. I don't know why people don't utilize talking to the press. Don't come for petty stuff, but like really talk to the press. Really get familiar about the press and the free speech, but also using, if you're in tough situations, the power of public shame and different virtues. Like, for example, there was a restaurant that was racially discriminating someone, and people went in Google reviews and just said, pss, pss, thumbs down reviews. And when they started getting like 4 or 3 stars, it became like, what's going on here? There's a lot of institutions, including this free library, which doesn't deserve bad reviews, but other places, right, that you go to allow surveys and feedback. Those are the places to organize and give the feedback. When you're giving people bad reviews, I mean, think about if you have a horrible Uber driver who's just a pig. You give them a one-star review, people keep saying the thing collectively, it builds momentum. You give a movie a bad review, you go on Netflix, you don't like something, they will change their whole algorithm based on your taste. So I'm saying to people, the things that we often ignore, the surveys we ignore, the feedbacks that we ignore, that's the places oftentimes to share that feedback in ways that helps change those systems. So if you're a person who may not have the ability to be like me and have thousands of followers on social media where I can light shit up, you can then take advantage of the fact that there's other public forums and spaces where you can review. You didn't like a restaurant, you thought the service was bad, but you couldn't stay at the restaurant because you didn't know the environment. You go to Google review. You go to Yelp.
We're going
to
see how many followers you have for a second. Yeah. We're going to check this.
But you can do those things. So I would say to people here who are trying to figure out how to speak out, that is the space to do that.
Yeah, 38,000 followers.
38,000. 38,000.
You only
need 12 apostles. You know?
What do we do next?
Time. We're going to sign books.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.